Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to empower people. And in that regard, we always start our program with the latest cutting-edge information on how to live a longer and healthier life. Today, for example, from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, we'll talk about how nurses are adapting a plant-based prescription to boost health outcomes. That's good. And children who play outside are more likely to protect nature as adults, University of British Columbia. And tea drinking slashes the risk of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease, according to the National University of Singapore. And also today, indigenous South American group has the healthiest arteries of all the people yet studied in the world. What are they doing? University of New Mexico tells us. We'll share it with you. And also, a 48-hour sexual afterglow helps to bond partners over time. That's good. So I'll talk about what that means. And for all of you who are not having 48 years sexual afterglow, a little short on the sex there, well, we'll deal with that. Florida State University. After all, liberals don't have sex. They have immaculate conception birth. Only the Republicans seem to have sex, or so they tell us. Today also, we're going to have a commentary by Chris Hedges, The Last Chance for Resistance from TruthDig. Chris Hedges will be my guest tonight at 7 p.m. for a full hour. And I'm not going to talk with him about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Obama. Instead, more important from my perspective is, why is it that less than 1% of the American population have turned out for any major protest? And that was the Women's March, and that was under 1%. But on almost all other major issues, nobody turns out. So I'm going to focus upon we the people. Also today, another commentary from Professor Henry Giroux, The Hardening of Society and the Rise of Cultures of Cruelty in Neo-Fascist America. And I was asked a question yesterday while traveling. A person said, you don't talk about the Federal Reserve. I hear a lot about it. Could you give me a perspective? So I thought, all right, I'll give a short perspective, but at least one that gives you an idea of why the Federal Reserve should be completely dismantled and no longer exist. And from our audio clip file today, we're going to talk or hear from an Irish girl. Difficult to understand all of it because it was not taken by a microphone. It was just someone recording off their cell phone. But I'll explain what she's saying. It's only a minute and a half long. She is in a wheelchair. She is facing, I believe, the head of the Irish government's health committee, the group that decides about mandatory vaccines. And also separate from that, why we should not have any money spent on nuclear weapons. Obama allocated $1 trillion. Hillary Clinton was going to take that trillion and increase it to create a whole new group of nuclear weapons. Donald Trump is also pro-nuclear weapons. Why they're all wrong. So you'll hear that clip. Also, from Abby Martin, we're going to hear about Steve Bannon. Now, Steve Bannon is to Trump what Karl Rove was to George Bush. There was actually a very good documentary called Bush's Brain, about the man who sits behind the president, makes all the real critical decisions, and has to explain to the president why something has to be done or not done. In other words, it's more than just an advisor. It's someone who literally forms the public policy issues and then deciphers it to the candidate. And then the candidate goes forth in their own manner articulates it to the public. We think it's coming from the president. It's not. It's coming from these special advisors. So what do we know about the man who is literally the co-president and far brighter than, well, that's not saying much, than the president, Steve Bannon? You'll hear more about him and why you should be very, very concerned. This dude is very smart. Anyone who suggests otherwise is simply not aware of it. But smart in what way? Heinrich Himmler was smart, had multiple degrees. Reinhard Goering was smart. There have been some smart people. That does not mean that that smartness is used in a benevolent or spiritual way. Bannon is a good example of that. So that's our program today. We have a lot to share. And if time permits, I'll be opening up the phones for talkback. Now, we're going to begin with something that we can all do, and I always like to select the topics we can actually do something with. They're not just kind of theoretical abstracts out there. Oh, that's interesting. No, how can I do that? The Physicians Committee, a good group, did a study, and they did a presentation at George Mason University about the health benefits of adopting a plant-based vegan diet, and a group of nurses decided to test it out. Well, after just 21 days, 3 weeks, 74% of the nurses said that the plant-based vegan diet lowered their cholesterol by 18 milligrams, while several others had it lowered even further, and more than half lost weight, an average of 4.4 pounds. This is only in 3 weeks. And also 30% reported gains in energy, and 41% reported feeling highly satisfied with their health, compared to one nurse who reported this before the dietary modifications. So it's working, and this was published in the American Journal of Nursing. Now, mind you, I think this is extremely important and very positive, because it's the nurse that interfaces more than the physician with the patients in hospital settings. Certainly that's the case in assisted living centers and in nursing homes and in those kind of visiting angels, the people that come into your home, more often than not, those are nurses. So they have the knowledge, if they've changed, to help other people change. So that's good. Quote, a plant-based, that's a vegan diet, provides a helpful template for all patients. But what I find works best is personalizing the approach. Good. I agree with that. I'm going to be doing a protocol starting this June. I'm not going to mention it now. The last one we did last year filled up, and we had 500 people in it with remarkable results. The actual study completed. The results have been submitted to peer-reviewed journals for publication and presentation before scientific groups. Saving lives is a big deal. Saving lives without any medicine, that's even a bigger deal because it's a different paradigm. Getting people to reverse the aging process, things they thought they could never do again, that's important as well. So we're going to add a whole lot of new into a new protocol, and I'll be in its Of course, it's a plant-based protocol. All the protocols for the last 40 years have been plant-based. From the University of British Columbia, beautiful place, by the way, protecting the environment can be as easy as telling your kids to go outside and play. That's according to a new study. And from the faculty up there, they found that 87% of the study respondents who played outside as children expressed a continued love of nature as young adults. And of that group, 84% said their taking care of environment was a major priority for them. Quote, developing positive experiences in nature at a young age can influence our attitudes and behaviors towards adults or towards nature as adults. Quote, it's important to study these childhood experiences in order to develop environmental awareness and action in the next generation. And that's really good. I'm sure many of you, like myself, because we're talking, mind you, all over the world right now, I'm sure that when you were growing up, many of you had an opportunity to be in Girl Scouts, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Sea Scouts, Order of the Arrow, one of the scouting programs, and that got you into nature and a respect for nature, living in cooperation with nature. For those in this audience who are lucky enough to have families that took them whitewater rafting or nature trips or wilderness quests, you had a chance to live in nature in all of its majesty and beauty and challenges. But a lot of kids don't get into nature. And I believe one of the things that we can do in this coming year is maybe do some form of a cooperative where I'd be willing to buy a farm upstate, depending upon where most people would be listening, but right now would probably be upstate New York or maybe over New Jersey, that would be used year-round as a place for teachers and families to take children. It would all be set up with animals, rescue animals, to show how animals should be treated and their place in our lives. They're not to be eaten. They're not to be kept in cages or corrals. They're should be gotten back to their natural habitats wherever possible. But also just understand that the bacon and eggs came from an animal. You know, the hamburger came from an animal. So if you see that animal in its own development and understand it, if a kid's able to go over and hug a goat or a lamb or a llama or a little heifer, they're far less likely to want to eat that. In fact, they almost constantly repel it. In fact, there was I put a clip up on my website, and it showed people going into a supermarket in South America. I think it was in Brazil, and they go over and they're sampling sausages. And then the man says to this couple, "Oh, I just ran out, but not a problem. I'll make some more real quick." So he gets a little tiny, cute little piglet that's in a little area beside it, opens the top lid and puts it in there. What the people don't know is that there's a trap door, and so the little piglet is going into the arms of a woman who's sitting on the ground. And then the guy starts grinding his machine, you hear a pig squealing, and then you see the sausage come out, and the people just freak out. They say, "Oh, no, don't want it, no." And the guy tries to stop. "No, stop." He says, "Too late, you know, we've made the sausage out of the pig, but isn't it good?" No. So every single person that came over, without exception, not one of them wanted to see the little pig become a sausage. Well, that's an important and powerful lesson. But what if you never see the little pig? What if you never know of their pain and their suffering? Of the pig, the fish, the whale, the porpoise. And in Japan, it's really, I'm going to have one of the leading feminists of all Japan. She is the leading one. I brought her into America a few years ago for the premiere of Knocking on the Devil's Door, Deadly Nuclear Legacy, right after Fukushima. But I want her, not me, to tell you about how racist, how misogynist, how corrupt, how vile the entire government of Japan is. These people are really not to be trusted. And so they're not saying a word about, you know, killing whales, having a bay which all the dolphin families go in there and then they slaughter them. For what? For a ritual? Yeah, a stupid ritual. So I'll let you tell her that story. I'll let her tell you that story. Also, the clubbing of the baby seals. We do things all over the world to animals. In the Orient, they boil dogs and cats. They actually have feasts, you know, a celebration where people see the puppy and then they are eating it. I believe that we are at a time where we should, with the advent of the internet going everywhere now, we should make every effort this year to educate the people about they have choices. Now, their ultimate choice is their choice, not ours. And we have to respect their right to a choice even when they're making a wrong choice. But at least let's try to convince as many people as possible through the more spiritual path of educating them by showing them animals, why they shouldn't be eaten, and educating them on the myths of meat essential or animal proteins to our diet. There is no need for any human being to have any animal protein in their diet ever in their whole life. And I have a new book on this coming out, and it's a massive book. It's taken 7 years to write, and it's the most powerful book that has been written to date on veganism. And I've been holding off releasing it until I get the final word on where the planet is going, because a lot of the book is based upon saving the planet. And one way is converting to veganism. But also I'm looking at the latest prognosis for the planet by 15 to 20 of the world's leading environmental experts, and they're telling the truth, and it's scary. Some are saying 9 years until the planet goes through major collapse in different systems. That does not mean, however, that the planet simply ceases and everybody dies. That's not what it's saying. It says within 9 years, because of the loss of Arctic sea ice, that we will create at least 10 feedback loops. Each and every one of those loops will have tremendously devastating consequences to the environment, which will then impact food production, water availability, heat, and cause major parts of the world, including the United States, no longer to be available for us to live in. So I'm on the next 4 weeks, I'm filming the final segments of that, and then I'll bring this out later. But anyhow, this, I was thinking about, wouldn't it be nice? I did this, by the way, for 13 years upstate, only in the summer, however. Every weekend, parents and churches and school teachers could bring groups up, and we would teach them, and I was there every weekend, about growing food naturally, taking care of animals, and loving nature, going into the woods and showing them what poison sumac and poison ivy and poison oak are, and how to identify trees and the role the trees played in that ecosystem. All the things kids find fascinating. But I need someone to head that project, someone who's very detailed, very focused, very disciplined, because otherwise it's a whole lot of effort, and I don't want to. I got so many projects on my plate right now, I can't put another one on, but I'm willing to put up the money to buy a place, an old farm, and fix it up. An old McDonald's farm for the modern thing, having solar, wind, if it's there, geothermal, and all the different types of sustainable agriculture, taking a roof off and putting a bell roof on, having a barn with solar, showing water filtration systems, just everything that kids would find really neat. You know, it's just an idea. I talk out loud sometimes on the air. What's Gary doing? He's just thinking out loud right now. So that's, when I think about something, that's how it starts. And then it gets done. Tea drinking, which is good if you're drinking green tea or oolong tea or white tea, slashes the risk of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease. This is from the National University of Singapore. Now, we know, by the way, that there are thousands of studies on the power of green tea and the specific chemicals in green tea. But now we know that it will cut by 50% the risk of cognitive impairment and also dramatically reduce the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And these were the findings in this longitudinal study that involved almost 1,000 senior citizens. And this was in the Department of Psychological Medicine at the National University of Singapore. So drink your tea and reduce your risk of your brain prematurely aging. That's good. It was published in the Journal of Nutrition, Health, and Aging. And finally, indigenous South American group has the healthiest arteries of all populations studied on the planet. This is in the University of New Mexico. These are people called the Tasman people, a forager horticulturalist population of the Bolivian Amazon. They have the lowest reported levels of vascular aging of any population with coronary atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. You ready for this? They're 500% less common than the average American. This is published in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and also presented at the American College of Cardiology. So what are they doing? Well, the researchers propose that the loss of subsistence diets and lifestyles in contemporary society could be classed as a new risk factor for heart disease. And the main risk factors are age, smoking, high cholesterol, which I disagree with. I think they're absolutely wrong there. High blood pressure, physical inactivity, obesity, and diabetes. The rest I agree with. Quote, our study shows that these indigenous South Americans have the lowest prevalence of coronary atherosclerosis of a population that's studied. And, quote, their lifestyle suggests that a diet low in saturated fats, well, that means no meat and no trans fats that you get in French fries, potato chips, pretzels, donuts, muffins, bread, and high in unprocessed fiber-rich carbohydrate. Ah, there would be your root vegetables, your fruits, vine fruits. So everything that grows, they would be eating unprocessed, plus occasionally wild game and fish. No smoking, and they're active throughout the day, and that's what's preventing the hardening of the arteries. Now, they also say in this, quote, the loss of subsistence diets and lifestyle could be classified as a new risk factor for vascular aging. And we believe that components of this way of life could benefit contemporary sedentary populations, end quote. Okay, something over the weekend, I got a call from, I was finishing up filming and had a day to rest and relax, and got a call from a couple who are friends of mine, and he is probably America's greatest chef, David Boulay, and was near my ranch. Could he come by? I said, sure. And what they were surprised by is he wanted to cook a meal, and I said, well, before you cook a meal, let's walk around. I have 87 different types of fruit growing, and each day I get myself, when I'm at home, I get a whole bowl. I feed it to the animals and myself. And by the time we finished this walk around, which took about an hour, he was fairly full. What's this? Well, that's a carabolo. What's that? Well, that's tamarind. What's that? And, well, that's a special type of cherry. You know, and suddenly you're eating 3, 4, 5 and a different type of plum, seven different types of grapefruit, 5 different types of bananas. In fact, I have a photograph that's up on my Facebook page, and you can go there to GaryNall.com and look under the Facebook, and you'll see a photo, and it's me with what I harvested just that morning. I'm going to say it's about 50 pounds because the jackfruit on there, which is relatively small, it's only 27 pounds. This is one fruit weighing 27 pounds. The largest one ever harvested was over 230 pounds. In any case, it tastes like bubble gum when you open it up, but it's best dried. You dry it, and then it lasts a long time. And then you take a little piece and throw it into a smoothie or have it as a snack. In any case, every one of the things you see there, I just harvested that morning. So here's the takeaway message. We can do things as simple as growing at least 100 variety of vegetables and fruits on our kitchen counter. So if you have a one-room studio, you do not have to have a big backyard. You can just have a room, and I can show you how to do it. If you have more room, let's say you have a little backyard, 20 by 40, the normal backyard, you could actually put up a hydroponic house and grow all of your fruits and vegetables for the entire year for a family of 5. And have left over to give to neighbors or church. That's what I do. Anything that is not harvested, I always turn over to local church groups to feed the homeless. So you could do the same. You can dry tomatoes and string beans and fruits You can dry them inexpensively. They still maintain all their nutrition because you're drying them at under 120 degrees, so it's still raw, living food. It's just in a state of suspended animation. So that's what you can do. You save a tremendous amount of money. You can grow over 40 types of sprouts. You can grow over 15 types of edible flowers. You can grow over 60 types of microgreens that can grow in a matter of 3 weeks. You got a whole giant tray. You can grow 100 different types of edible herbs. You can grow cinnamon basil, lemon basil, lime basil, wonderful things, sawgrass or lemongrass. So your kitchen could just be a phenomenal testing ground for you to try different seasonings and see which ones you like. Each day, try different brown rice and then put different seasonings in. Like, have you ever tried, let's say, tarragon with brown rice? It gives a very aromatic quality. And then cumin with brown rice. And then fennel with brown rice. So there's no reason we should have boring foods. But it gets back to the idea you're actually doing something. You're growing something, just like the native population in this South American Bolivian community. They're growing things. We need to grow things again. We need to have what many of us growing up as babies, after World War II, our families had victory gardens. Victory garden was a victory after World War II, and everybody had a garden. Everybody was growing stuff. And it was wonderful. And a lot of that went on to about the early 70s, and then it stopped for most people. But it's time to do it all over again. Victory gardens. And I can show you how to grow potatoes, sweet potatoes, yams, regular potatoes, fingerling potatoes, 12 months a year using bales. So anyhow, a whole lot of new stuff's happening, a lot of good stuff, all positive. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today. I mentioned I would give some insights about the Federal Reserve. And first, Mike Snyder from Activist Post just sent the latest amount here. It's $359,796,000,000 that have been forcibly extracted from American taxpayers was transferred into other hands. Now, here's the deal. So you got to listen carefully. When it comes to the Federal Reserve, almost all the money the Federal Reserve prints and distributes goes into the hands of the global elite, the major corporations. Doesn't go into your and my pockets. So what did the American people get in return for the nearly $400 billion given to these corporations? Nothing at all. No roads were built, no schools were constructed, no teachers were paid. It was simply interest that was owed on the national debt, and most of it has just made the ultra-wealthy even wealthier. But that is exactly what the Federal Reserve System was designed to do when it was created back in 1913. It was designed to get the U.S. government trapped into an endless spiral of debt that would systematically drain the wealth of the American people and transfer it to the ultra-wealthy and the international bankers, who were the only ones allowed to create the Federal Reserve. And when most people think of a wealth redistribution scheme, they think of a government raising taxes in order to give money to poor people, right? But the Federal Reserve System works in reverse. Money is taken from all of us, and it is redistributed to the global elite. That's why the federal income tax was instituted the exact same year that the Federal Reserve System was. Money is extracted from all of us through taxation, and then it is transferred from the federal government to the ultra-wealthy through debt payments. So what role does the Federal Reserve play in all this? Well, I've heard people say that the Federal Reserve focuses upon how much money it can make in a given year. But that's not true. That's a mistake. The truth is that the Fed returns the vast majority of the money that it makes to the U.S. Treasury. The Fed is not a money-making machine itself. Rather, and here's where you have to look at the nuance, it is a system that enables others to make hundreds of billions of dollars each year. And I think that it is easiest to think of the Fed as a middleman between the U.S. government and the global elite. It was designed by the international bankers for the benefit of the international bankers. The entire goal of the Federal Reserve System is to make the ultra-wealthy even wealthier. The Fed is a privately owned bank cartel of 12 regional banks, but we do not know who the major stockholders are in those banks, and they do profit from this. And they have a virtual monopoly over money creation in the United States. For example, no one else, including the U.S. government, can print money. So that the claim that the U.S. government can simply print money is dead wrong. When the U.S. government wants to spend more money than it has, it asks the Fed to make some more money. The Fed then creates money out of thin air and more than what had previously existed. Now, normally, this money is not even printed. It's just entered into a computer. In return for the new money, the government gives the Federal Reserve some U.S. Treasury bonds. In essence, U.S. Treasury bonds are promises to pay back money. They're IOUs. But the U.S. government always agrees to pay back more money than it receives. So a larger amount of debt is created than the amount of new money that is created. And when the Federal Reserve receives these U.S. Treasury bonds, most of the time they take them and auction them off, and those are purchased by other international banks or major financial groups. You and I are left out of the equation altogether. So what is the ideal? The ideal is to completely dismantle the Federal Reserve, turn over the right to print money exclusively to the Treasury at zero interest. If we did that and then forgave all of the debt that is owed, including all the interest and the principal to all the banks that didn't actually spend the money in the first place, then we would have zero debt and we could start fresh and no longer do any other quantitative easing or bailouts. If any corporation fails, let them go through a structured bankruptcy, as would be the normal and proper way of doing it. More on the Federal Reserve coming up. In about 5 minutes now, we're going to go to my guest in Northern Georgia, Professor Paul Craig Roberts. We're going to continue with our conversations with Remarkable Minds on the continuation of the hidden hand conversations about the deep state and who really rules over the United States and the recent WikiLeaks release of over 8,000 CIA documents. And he is an insider. He knows what this is about. Before we go there, however, I just want to take 1 second for our last discussion of our retreats, 1 week and the first week of April and then the second week. And we have on the line someone who was at recently a retreat, and she is here to tell us her experience. So if someone has never been to a retreat, would like to know what happens at a retreat. And I did the last two retreats as a fundraiser that went to pay for the premiums of our sister station, WBAI. And more than 2,000 premiums were paid for by the efforts of a wonderful group of about 20 volunteers who came together and to make that happen. And that way people would regain trust in the WBAI and also get their premiums. And her name is Mary Lynn. Hi, Mary Lynn.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm fine. Tell people what you came with and what you left with.
It was one of the most beautiful and wonderful experiences of my life. It really was. It was life-changing. It was so calming being on the grounds. And the grounds, the atmosphere is so peaceful and full of life, energy, and the people there were so loving and calm. Just being around the people in their calm state puts you in a very peaceful inner calm within you. And also the food, besides, the food was outrageous. It was nutritional, organic, nourishing. It was all vegan and absolutely delicious. It was just like having a gourmet meal at every meal. And
How much weight did you lose?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the first 25 pounds, actually. The first week I lost 10, and then the second week I lost another 10.
How many other people who were there just talking on the last day about what happened to them, how many other people lost weight in that 1 or 2 weeks?
Oh, my gosh. Everybody. Everybody lost weight. Everybody.
How many people came with depression and anxiety left feeling lighthearted and without depression or anxiety?
Oh, it was just miraculous. Everybody was so loving and calm, and we had made such wonderful friends, lifelong friends. And speaking of which, I met a wonderful guy. His name was Tommy. I met him there, and he's like my soulmate, and we're still together and loving every minute, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. I'll never forget it. And the exercising, I was never able to get myself up and exercising on a continual basis. But when you came out with us and you exercised with us every morning, that was such an inspiration to me that I was able to keep it up and still continue to exercise. And I just can't thank you enough, Gary, for how wonderful, wonderful that experience was. It was joyous.
Thank you, Mary Lynn. Well, we're out of time. I just wanted people to realize this is not like a vacation. It's not like going off to a yoga retreat. This is a place to come to change your life, to get your mood up, to get your energy up, to get your vitality up, to get yourself remotivated to care for yourself, of what you eat, how you think. Every night I do a workshop on critical thinking, on the important issues. And in the daytime, we have yoga, meditation. We have it's a beautiful grounds. This is no faux finish. This is real authentic. Italian artisans made this back in the 1920s, the location you're going to be at, in the gorgeous hills of East Texas, also Louisiana, and Arkansas. So you're right in the middle of hill lake country. So it's a wonderful once-in-a-lifetime experience. This is the last time we're doing it for a long time. So give Luann a call. Luann, give them your number, please. Luann, is Luann there?
Yeah.
No?
Oh. I'm here.
You fell asleep, Luann.
No, I was right here.
No,
I
you
was
fell asleep.
Gary. I was meditating.
You had a bologna sandwich and got brain fog.
No sandwiches here.
All right, give them your phone number.
Sure. It's 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008. Give me a call. We were full up. We had one or two people that had to reschedule their time. So I do have a couple of openings, and I talked to everybody. And by the way, Mary Lynn's sister was also with us. And do you remember, Gary? She couldn't walk 20 feet. And by the end of the week, she power walked. She power walked 3 miles, and she was racing with you. It was the most amazing thing to see. But this is the kind of stuff that happens. People transcend their limits, and they become more authentic, their more authentic selves. And that's what this is about. So give me a call, 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. 7008.
Thank you, Luann. Now let's go down to Northern Georgia. Standing by is Professor Paul Craig Roberts. He's one of today's most progressive political and economic writers and commentators on the state of the nation and government dysfunction and political corruption and global domestic economic threats, the war on terror. He deals with all this. He is also a very prolific author. He writes an outstanding a newsletter that or articles that I read regularly. And he has also been on the faculty of Tulane University, Stanford University, George Mason University, and he held the William Simon Chair of Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University. His blog is paulcraigroberts.org, and his latest book, I believe his latest, is The Neoconservative Threat to World Order, Washington's Perilous War on Hegemony. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
How important is the WikiLeaks release of the Vault 7 documents? And if you had a chance to look at them, tell us what your perspective is, because the media is not touching on them at all. They're just attacking Julian Assange as being a Russian agent. Everyone today is a Russian agent. And I think it's important that we understand what WikiLeaks has actually given us that allows us to have better understand the CIA.
Well, these are CIA documents. And so it's really what the CIA gave us, because they collected this arsenal of cyber weapons and failed to protect it, and it somehow got away from them and was floating around the Internet, and that's how it came to WikiLeaks. In other words, as I understand Julian Assange, this was not a direct leak to WikiLeaks from the CIA. The CIA simply failed to protect its own arsenal of cyber weapons. And what this Vault 7 collection shows is that the CIA can penetrate anything. It can bypass all encryption so that encrypted information is no longer secure. And not only can it bypass all encryption, but it can steal documents and leave someone else's fingerprint as evidence against the innocent third party. So the CIA could go into, say, some agency, the federal government, steal documents and leave a Russian fingerprint. And so what it really means, Gary, is that the very concept of evidence disappears, because there's no way to tell whether the evidence is false or planted. This is the most important part of the revelation, and that is that the concept of evidence no longer exists, because the CIA can leave anybody's fingerprint. And there's no way to tell that it was the CIA who hacked the documents. And there's no way to tell that the fingerprint left is planted or false. So that's basically what the Vault 7 documents are. And the implications are horrendous, because it simply means it's no longer any evidence, or what is the same thing, all evidence can be fabricated.
All right, fair enough. One of the revelations of the recent WikiLeaks release of troves of CIA correspondence and documents is that there is an enormously powerful cabal, a power and influence within the CIA, and even other factions in the CIA are unaware of the existence or elect to ignore it. To me, that represents a dangerous precedent, that there is, in effect, a group so powerful they're accountable to no one.
Well, that's kind of always been the case with the covert operations. And some people criticize the way the CIA was formed out of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Studies, during the, which was the World War II intelligence service of the U.S. They say that the covert operations should have been taken out of the agency. If you were going to keep them, they should have been a separate organization. So the sort of the general view of those critical of the agency is that by including covert operations within the CIA, it allowed the covert operations to subvert the agency and force the agency's intelligence functions to support whatever agenda the covert agency was, the covert part of the agency was pursuing, so that even the analytical part of the CIA became turned away from its function of reliable intelligence to supporting whatever agenda was operating in the covert part of the agency.
I appreciate that insight. I think this release throws all the charges against Russia meddling in the election, the DNC leaks, the Trump nominees and cabinet members fraternizing with the Russians, and even Trump's recent claims that the Democratic Party and Obama were directly behind the assumed bugging of Trump Tower into disarray, because any of one of these could have been a black flag operation carried out by elements within the CIA. And Uri Friedman for the publication Defense One wrote a recent piece titled "America is Facing a Dangerous Enemy. We just can't agree upon who it is." And yet I feel these recent documents are going to shed a lot more light on the problem and can potentially be equal or even more important than Snowden's release of documents. And that's my opinion. I don't believe I'm exaggerating on that. And second, who do you know now that is willing to come forward and say, hey, look, if all of you intelligence agencies, if all you media are saying that Russia interfered in our election and therefore Trump's election is invalid and this needs to be, you know, told from every point we can, at what point do they actually bring their evidence forward? Because I have yet to see that evidence, nor do I know anyone else who could see the evidence to make a compelling case. If they have it, show it. If they don't have it, then isn't the responsibility of people like that used to be one of the top reporters of the Wall Street Journal to say, we can't publish any more of your theories until you have some facts to support them? Your thoughts?
Well, Gary, let me put this in context for you and the, and your audience. What all of this fight about Russian influence in our elections is about is the $1,000 billion annual budget of the military security complex. A budget of this size and the enormous power that goes with it requires a dangerous enemy. And Russia has been recreated as that dangerous enemy. So the orchestrated Russian threat is absolutely necessary for the budget and power of the military security complex. So when Trump said that he was going to normalize relations with Russia, what that means is he is erasing the Russian threat. If he is permitted to erase the Russian threat, what is the justification for the $1,000 billion annual budget? None. Zero. And so you see then that the military security complex, about which President Eisenhower warned us in, I think, 1961, now we're talking about more than a half century ago, and if the complex struck Eisenhower as dangerous then, just imagine how much more entrenched it is after another half century. So by threatening such a powerful entrenched interest, Trump brought them out against him. And that's what all these charges of Russian influence in the elections is about. It's about protecting the existence of the Russian threat and showing that it extends now even into the office of the President of the United States. And it's being used to prevent Trump from normalizing relations with Russia. Because if he normalizes relations with Russia, it then confirms the propaganda that he's a Russian agent. And this is the reason he hasn't fired Admiral Mike Rogers at the NSA or the FBI Director Comey, both of whom yesterday before the House Intelligence Committee operated directly against the President of the United States, both of whom declared Russia to be the principal enemy of the United States, a dangerous enemy that intends to hurt us. These are total direct contradictions of the policy of the President of the United States. So why doesn't he fire them? Because he can't. If he fires them, it's confirmation that he's covering up, firing the people investigating his Russian connections. So what we are faced with now is a conflict between facts, which I believe Trump has, that the Russians are not a threat, and that in the interest of humanity, we need normal relations between nuclear powers, not a high level of tension and distrust that could lead to Armageddon. Between that and one side of the conflict, the other side is the military security complex working to defend their massive budget and power. So the outcome of this conflict basically determines the future of humanity. We don't know who's going to win. It's not clear. It's difficult even for the Republicans to support Trump. Not so much because of the prostitutes in the media and their propaganda, but because every member of the House and Senate is dependent on campaign contributions from the military security complex and their associated interests. So if Trump wins, it'll be a major achievement. If he loses, then we are stuck with some growing conflict with the Russians that can't end well. So that's essentially what is going on.
But wouldn't
what,
you?
What Snowden revealed was what William Binney had already told us. You know, Binney was the NSA official who developed the spy capability for the National Security Administration. He went public when he saw it was being used against Americans, not against foreign enemies. But he didn't steal any documents and couldn't prove it, and so they simply said, oh, he's just disaffected. So Snowden saw that, and he realized that blowing the whistle doesn't do any good. You have to have the proof. That means you have to steal the documents. So that's what Snowden did. So what was Snowden's contribution was to point out to the entire world that the NSA spies on everybody and can collect any form of electronic communication anywhere at any time. So the NSA could no longer deny that it was circumventing the Constitution and the FISA law and all the rest. Now, what Vault 7 is, we've already said, it simply shows that the CIA collected a vast arsenal of cyber weapons, lost control over it, it got loose. We don't know who has it. It came to WikiLeaks, and what it shows without any doubt whatsoever is that the CIA can avoid all encryption, can hack anything, and can leave some and leave evidence that it was done by someone else. So those are the achievements of Vault 7 and Snowden. And
okay,
to recap briefly, what we're seeing now is the conflict between Trump, who wants to avoid conflict between nuclear powers, and the military security complex, which needs a major enemy in order to justify taking from American taxpayers every year $1,000 billion.
I'd like to share a perspective for your final thoughts on this. When we take a very careful look, a forensic look, we see that 98% of all the major corporations, the entirety of the military-industrial complex, all of its major corporations, the pharmaceutical companies, the Wall Street, they all backed Hillary Clinton. And if you were a good liberal, not a Democrat, corporate liberal, but if you were just a decent person who cared about not having war and income equality and a living wage and a clean environment and clean water and clean air, you would have asked, why in the world would everyone who's polluting, manipulating, whose whole philosophy is one of hegemony, why would they be voting for Hillary Clinton, supporting her? And then you look at the Clinton Foundation, look at all the deals done with Russia, by the way, including on uranium deals, and you'd say, because clearly she's their person, as Bill Clinton was. Now, then anything that they wanted, they knew she would not stop. So we would probably have Israel having a war with Iran and inflaming the entire world into a third world war, or NATO posturing itself around Russia, where we could also have another conflict with Russia. And so Jill Stein would have been the logical person to have voted for, or at least Bernie Sanders, though Bernie is still also a neocon when it comes to foreign policy in the military-industrial complex. However, when the media looks at it all has the resources to do the same evaluation, and it hasn't. So therefore, it's not that it could not do the evaluation to show why everyone wanted Hillary to win and why they hate Trump and want Trump now to walk away from his office as if somehow this is a corporation he can no longer control and therefore leave. And he may actually do that. I don't see him staying 2 years if the pressure keeps up. So that's my take on this. And the Vault 7 simply confirms that any dirty trick, any false flag the CIA wants to do and blame it on anyone, including Trump, they could do so, or the Russians, and they could do so. So when they're asked to provide evidence, because I believe if the CIA, the National Security Agency, Homeland Security, if all these supposed heads of all these 17 agencies had the absolute proof, as I was listening last night on one of Fox programs, I wanted to see how they were handling this, and this California Democrat said, we got to punish Russia, got to punish Russia. And Tucker Carlson said, what do you want, a war with Russia? And you could see how this person wanted to say yes, but knew politically that would be disadvantageous. So he just kept saying that they interfered. But now, no matter what show you watch, they're all saying the same thing. Russia hacked the DNC. No, they didn't. There's no proof whatsoever they hacked the DNC. Julian Assange said that he got a thumb drive and documents given to him by a British, former British ambassador in a park in Virginia, and that's it. And there has not been once in 10 years and 10 million documents Julian Assange has been shown to be wrong on that. Yet they lie perpetually. They lie as a business. They have 5,000 people every day that go to work to figure out propaganda and lie, and the media doesn't bring that up. So then what this means is that when you put together the neocons and you put together the media, is there a possibility that they could get Trump to quit? Because someone just said, Dianne Feinstein, the Senate Judiciary Committee person, said yesterday that Trump could step down. Do you see him stepping down, and how do you see this coming to a fruition?
Well, I don't think he'll step down. They may succeed in forcing him off his agenda of improving relations with Russia. That's the question. There's no evidence of any of the stuff that they've said, as you observe. There's no evidence. But they don't need evidence because the media speaks with one voice. Look, we have a number of books out, two new ones. In 2014, the German, Udo Ufkati, the editor of the big German newspaper, published a book called Bought Journalism. An English translation is supposed to be out in May. He says there's no significant journalist anywhere in Europe that's not on the CIA's payroll. There have been a number of books about the CIA's control, influence in the U.S. media. There's a new one out, and I make a reference to it in my last column, The Conspiracy Against President Trump. This person names the American journalist, gives the examples of where they were used by the CIA. And so the CIA, since the beginning, has understood that it needs to control explanations if it's going to control the agenda. And so it uses the journalists throughout Europe and the United States, and most likely in Canada and Australia, to control the explanations that people get. I mean, Udo Ufkati says the CIA would bring me the news stories that they had written, and I would publish them under my name. So if they can control the explanations, they don't need evidence. And the media is never going to ask them. They're just going to repeat, as you observe, they just repeat the charges. No one has any evidence because it's not needed, because the media belongs to the CIA. So this is why we've had the rise of the alternative media and the discrediting of the print and TV media is the reason for these new lists of fake news sites, of Russian agent sites, Russian dupe sites, on which they put those of us who do try to give accurate accounts of what's going on. So we now have the list that Prop or Not did that was in the Washington Post. We have the list that some unheard-of assistant professor of communications at some small college that got posted in the Harvard University Library website. We now have, according to people who write to me from France, a list from Le Monde, the big newspaper, of sites that tell the truth, but the truth is now defined as fake news. So the prestitutes, the print and TV media throughout the West, realizes they're losing influence, they're losing control of the explanations, and so they're now trying to discredit the alternative media by producing lists that are blacklists. Oh, this one has fake news. This one is a Russian agent. This one is Putin's dupe. And this shows a desperation.
It's McCarthyism.
So how it plays out remains to be seen. That's okay. The conflict that we're in. You're doing your part. I'm doing my part. Others are doing their part. And we'll see how it turns out.
Well, I appreciate the good work you're doing. And, again, I'm recommending people to go to Paul Craig Roberts' site, paulcraigroberts.org, and his new book is The Neoconservative Threat to World Order. Thanks for being on today.
You're sharing your audience with me, Gary. All the best.
Okay. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Remember, tonight, 7 o'clock, you will not want to miss Chris Hedges, a full hour. Have a nice day.